Please silence all electronic devices.
I just think it's a shame that, you know, those kind of accusations are made against candidates.
It's just political reality. It's not an accusation.
Again, I think the more debate and the more discussion and the more openness that we have with this, the better.
Any further discussion or debate?
From downtown Raleigh, you are tuned into the WUNC Politics Podcast. Good of you to click play, as always, and join us for that weekly discussion about some of what happened in North Carolina politics. Now, less than 50 days until that Super Tuesday primary, and among the things on the docket today, a couple of interesting stories. One about a candidate for governor, another about election machines, and that could affect you come Super Tuesday and March 3rd. Here for our discussion, Becky Gray of the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
State lawmakers gaveled in Tuesday for one day of action. Two votes to override gubernatorial vetoes failed. No vote was taken on whether to override the vetoed state budget. What it means, in part, still no new state budget, no teacher raises, no breakthrough on significant compromise. It's looking increasingly likely that we may not get a new complete state budget until 2021. This is now a seven-month budget impasse. Where does it go from here?
No indication that there is a breakthrough in sight. Senator Berger has made pretty clear he doesn't have any intention of compromising or working out a compromise. I think it's a sad development. I really do think it would be better if we could get a fully implemented state budget with all the components in it. There's a lot of things that have fallen through as a result of our failure to do so. A lot of people being left in the lurch. I heard a story this week about how some staff for the juvenile justice folks who are actually, Melissa Boughton at NC Policy Watch wrote about this, about they're implementing Raise the Age, and they've got a couple of positions that they had anticipated being funded to help them meet the new demands. It's all sort of hung up in the budget impasse. There's, you know, undoubtedly scores of examples like that. But at this point, there seems to be no indication that even on, for instance, the matter of teacher pay, Senator Berger doesn't seem to have any indication that he's willing to just even negotiate a separate mini budget on that. Not much hope right now at this point.
Well, we had a mini budget on the teacher pay. That was one of the, and the governor vetoed it. It came back over here for consideration about an override on that veto, and the Democrats stuck together and would not vote to override the veto. So we've already had a mini budget that just considers the teacher pay. Again, the governor vetoed it, came back over here. That was part of what they did on Tuesday. But, you know, one thing that I think is important to point out is, you know, Jeff, you mentioned we don't have a new state budget, and that is true, but we do have a state budget because according to law in North Carolina, if there is not a budget, it reverts back to last year's spending. So we don't have a budget that either side is particularly happy with, but we do have a budget that's working in North Carolina. So I think that's important to point out, too, that as we're going through this, we do have a budget in place. Teachers have gotten five consecutive pay increases over the last 5 years. That's still put into place. As Rob mentioned, I mean, there was some new funding that was part of that proposed budget that the governor vetoed, have not been able to override that veto. There was some important funding in that budget. The Brody School of Medicine is one with a $255 million appropriation for an addition to the medical school, which is important not only to the Brody School of Medicine, but to Eastern North Carolina and the access to care. And there's other things in there certainly that were not funded, but we do have a budget and we're actually doing quite well.
Are Republicans unhappy that there's no budget? They seem perfectly content to me, but maybe you've had other conversations.
They've made every effort to put that. When you go back to, gosh, you know, I mean, I guess it's been almost a year that there were budgets proposed. The governor did his first proposal, I think in February maybe of last year. And
not
we've
quite
gone
a year, but it's
through
been a while.
This. Yeah, we've certainly a while. Yeah, we've gone through the system. The Republicans put together what they felt like was a responsible budget. Republicans and Democrats voted for that budget, that conference committee. The budget process went through the usual iterations, conference committee, final budget, passed with Republican and Democrat vote, went over to the governor. He vetoed it, and we've been at an impasse for this new budget ever since then.
But, of course, the way this is supposed to work is that the legislature passes a budget, the governor vetoes the budget, and then the two sides get together and compromise and find some common ground. And that's where we haven't had any real significant give from the Republican leadership of the General Assembly. They have decided they would rather do this. They would rather have mini budgets that allow all kinds of things to fall through the cracks than compromise on any significant matter to acknowledge the fact that we have divided government, that that's how it's supposed to work. That's what the people voted for in 2018. They've refused to do that.
So you don't think that the governor has issued an ultimatum when it comes to Medicaid? Or do you think he has? And if he has, isn't that part of the reason that there has been this stalemate in terms of just mere negotiations and conversations?
Well, we've talked about the fact that there are Republican versions of Medicaid expansion that have been pushed forward. I've said before in this space, and I would say it again, that I would guarantee you that some version of that would be fine with Governor Cooper if the Republicans would honor the members of their own party, a group that voted overwhelmingly to get such a bill out of a committee in the House. I think there would be common ground, but we haven't even had them sit down and negotiate it. They've been unwilling to. As I said a long time ago, what needed to happen here was that they needed to lock the four legislative leaders and the governor in a room and tell them to, you know, and they needed to have a pact to get this done before they left Raleigh. And they just, there was never a willingness on the legislative leadership to do that.
Let me ask you a follow-up here on Medicaid. This is not in front of me, so I'm going to ramble through it, I imagine. We have a sense from our reporting and being in this building that Medicaid expansion might be approved by a majority of the House members. When you think about there are 55 Democrats, they would need six Republicans to do that. Now, do a majority of Republicans in the House support that? That's unclear. But there would be enough people to support it and move it forward. It has been, I'm just trying to lay this out for listeners here, it has been, we talk about the show of unity by the Democrats upholding a veto of the governor. It's also been kind of a show of unity by Republicans not to advance Medicaid expansion from one chamber to the other, because that would put Berger in a bit of a pickle. That would almost side more with Cooper. Is that a fair assessment of the lack of Medicaid expansion that we've seen, and one reason why?
Well, I think the main reason why we haven't seen it is, number one, the governor came out really with a non-negotiable point that he was only interested in a budget that included Medicaid expansion. So that was a position that he put out from the very beginning. Even before the Republicans had sent a budget over, he had said, I'm not going to approve anything if it doesn't have Medicaid expansion, period. So that limits the discussions and the negotiations right there. There has been talk in the House about Medicaid expansion, and my view is there's very mixed feeling on that within the caucus and the details of it and those kind of things.
Right, but you don't disagree with me that if Medicaid expansion in a relatively narrow form, if put on the House floor, would be approved by a majority of the North Carolina House.
I don't know that because we haven't had that vote.
But that's the question. I think it would.
Okay,
you disagree with me.
I'm not sure that it would.
I think
okay.
It passed
I'm
committee
sure
25 to 6 was my recollection
right.
of what the
I
vote was.
I can't remember how many Republicans there were, but there were some.
Significant.
But whether or not it would pass in the House, the Senate has made it clear they are not interested in Medicaid expansion, and they're not going to give in to the demands that the governor has made. Now, what the House or what the General Assembly has said is, we believe that health care is important. We believe that if people can't afford health insurance, we need to look at lowering the cost of health care so that people can afford that health insurance. And we'd like to talk about that in a they've made that offer to the governor. Let's go ahead, get the budget passed, get teacher the pay increases, all the other things that are in this proposed budget, and then let's talk about health care. And Medicaid expansion would be part of that discussion, but it wouldn't be the only part of that discussion. And that's where I think the governor has dug his heels in.
That's where you think it's broken down.
Yeah.
Clearly it's broken down.
Yeah, but I think that's where it's broken down.
The bottom line is
the governor has made it clear he's not interested in negotiating that. It is Medicaid expansion or nothing.
Now, just
he's very interested in negotiating. The bottom line is that Medicaid expansion is going to happen in North Carolina. It may not happen in 2020, but it's going to happen. It just happened in Kansas, another deeply red state. It's happening in state after state, and there's no holding back the tide. Eventually, it's going to happen here. We're going to save thousands of lives and bring in billions of federal dollars.
Let me ask you both one more speculative question about this ongoing budget impasse. It seems, at least anecdotally to me, that educators have largely stand with the governor. But at some point, they're going to grow tired, I think, of both sides and not just Republicans. Do you have a sense of when that might be?
It's not going to happen in 2020, I don't think.
You think teachers stay united around the governor through November 3rd?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think maybe the turning point may have been this week, because what has happened was in the big budget, there was a 4.9% pay increase plus a $1,000 bonus average for teachers. The governor vetoed it. He was able to get the Democratic caucus to stay with him. The other offer with this mini budget, the teacher pay, the one that they considered this week, it was a 3.9% pay increase. Again, the governor vetoed it, made the Democrat caucus stick with him. So the Republicans have done everything they can to get the teachers a raise. The Democrats and the Democratic caucus have said no. So where we stand
silly.
Now
Obviously.
Is they get nothing.
The governor called for a much larger raise. To say that they've done nothing is just silly. The governor and the Democrats have called for larger raises for teachers.
They voted no for 4.9%, and they voted no for a 3.9% pay increase.
Right, because it was inadequate.
After this week, the teachers get nothing.
It was inadequate because it was paired with these ridiculous tax cuts.
So nothing is more inadequate than 3.9%.
It's an important stand to take a stand of principle to show that this is inadequate, and it's not, and they're not going to be bought off so cheap.
And the teachers get nothing.
They will. I think they're confident in the long run the education system of the state will be better off if they stick to their guns.
Before we move on, I will note that lawmakers have gone home until the end of April. If this 3.5-month break holds, and I actually expect that it will, mm-hmm. it will mark the longest break here in 4 years. Republican U.S. Senator Tom Tillis on Wednesday challenged his general election opponents to a series of debates, 5 of them, in fact. That is a lot of debates and an unusual request for an incumbent to make. Did it strike you as strategic, desperate, or both?
Maybe a little of both. I thought he's obviously worried. He's one of the most vulnerable senators in the country. He's got to find something to sort of inject some energy. He's seen as sort of this, you know, flip-flopping lapdog to Trump. And so anything he can do to give himself a forum to try to show some independence or some sort of, you know, chance to show his voice in public probably would be beneficial to him. But I'm sure whoever the Democratic nominee will be happy to take him up on it in all likelihood, because it's going to give them more visibility and name recognition too.
I think that the more discussion that we have, the more debate and going back and forth, head-to-head discussions between candidates makes the whole system better. It makes people accountable for what their positions are, gives them the opportunity to explain theirs. So, I mean, I think I commend Senator Tillis for doing this. The 5 debates with his Democratic opponent, I understand Spectrum News has already arranged or committed to televising these in April, May, and June, I think it is. It's after the primary, so it will likely be the winner of the Democratic primary. I think the more debate that we have with this, the more that we get to know the candidates, the better. So I commend Senator Tillis. I think we ought to have more debates rather than fewer.
So we've got 46 days until the Super Tuesday primary. You would support Senator Tillis having some debates with his Republican challengers before the primary?
Well, I don't think that's what he has proposed.
No, it's not. But I'm saying
in
light of—
My only question with that was, is there time?
There's 46 days.
Well, then sure. I mean, I think the more debates and discussions we have, the better. I mean, you know, I think they should come on this show, and you should moderate it, Jeff.
Come on in,
Senator
Tillis. I
think the bottom line, obviously, is that if Senator Tillis were running way ahead in the polls and thought he was a shoo-in for re-election, there isn't a chance he would even acknowledge that he had a Democratic opponent. This is what politicians—this is the playbook. When you're running, you know, in a tight race or you're running scared, you call for debates.
And I just think it's a shame that, you know— those kind of accusations are made against candidates.
It's just political reality. It's not an accusation.
I think the more debate and the more discussion and the more openness that we have with this, the better.
My colleague Rusty Jacobs produced a good story this week about voting machines. Some of the takeaways: state law now requires all new systems to produce a paper ballot that a voter can check. Nearly 25 counties, about a fourth in the state, will be using new election equipment to replace antiquated touchscreen systems. Mecklenburg and Guilford counties, that's the first and the third largest in North Carolina by population, are going in different directions. Guilford going with hand-marked paper ballots. Meck moving ahead with new touchscreen systems. Those devices are not connected directly to the internet. However, some advocates warn that they're still susceptible to election hacking. What concerns, if any, do you have about voting machines in North Carolina in 2020?
My concern with the voting machines, it really comes down to, do voters have confidence in their vote, and will it impact voters coming out to vote? Are there any questions about the integrity of it? That's what my concern is, you know, to be honest with you. I understand these decisions have to be made. In many of our counties, the voting equipment is 15, 20 years old. And so then you have the danger of, is it going to work? The time is here. Anytime you make a switch, change is hard for anybody. And with this, we just want to make sure that it works to the point that we can. I don't think that there is any voting system that is 100% guaranteed. I think we've seen that across the country, different vendors, different ways of doing it. But my biggest concern is, do voters have confidence in the integrity of the voting system and have the confidence that we'll take them to the polls?
I actually agree, and I think there's a lot of reason that a lot of voters have been concerned. The whole phenomenon of Russian hacking in the 2016 election is, you know, has put the scare into a lot of people, a lot of concern, especially for machines that are linked to the internet or that are computer-based. I still think that hand-marked paper ballots are the gold standard. I still don't understand why we have myriad different systems across the state. It seems to me there ought to be one uniform system, solid, you know, uniform system across the state that everybody uses in every county, and that's exactly the same. I think that would be the best. That said, I think it's better to have a machine that spits out a paper version of what you press on the computer than to just have these touch screens where it disappears into the ether and you have no real idea if it marked your ballot properly. But I think it's understandable people are concerned, and I think that's a real problem because we need people to turn out and vote. It's important that they come out to vote and be a part of the democratic process in 2020.
Another interesting story that dropped this week came from your outpost, Rob, NC Policy Watch. House Representative Holly Grange, who is running for the Republican nomination for governor, did not disclose a family-owned business on her statement of economic interest. She disclosed several related businesses per this report. Unclear if this is an honest oversight or something nefarious. We don't know unless you were to tell us something different here. This report points out that there are now just 8 people in the department who review these statements of economic interest. And there are hundreds and hundreds of candidates in North Carolina. Is more oversight needed? And if so, how much more?
A lot more. I mean, I thought it was sort of poignant and shocking when the official who's interviewed in the story admitted that they had 8 employees, and they literally do not check to see if people are filing their forms properly because there's just literally no way to do it. Unless somebody complains, it's just a free-for-all out there. It's like golf. It's self-regulating, self-governing. There's no umpire checking things out. So that's very worrisome. And I thought Representative Grange chose not to talk to our reporter. They said her campaign said they'd check into the matter. I think the hope and maybe even the expectation is that this was just an oversight. She had a wide array of these sort of military training businesses where they train weekend warriors and teach you how to shoot and avoid being kidnapped and all this stuff. And maybe this one business that was registered as a business, but for which she did not report on her statement of economic interest, it was just an oversight. The business actually appears to have gone out of business. But still, it would be really nice if she'd come forward and just say what the deal is with it.
That is one of the ventures that her husband is involved with.
Right.
He's a retired 2-star general. I'm going to pull the curtain back here and offer you an apology, Becky. We generally have emails among the three of us, and we share topics and stories. And as I started to read that last question, I thought, oh, you know what? I forgot to prompt Becky and let her know that I might ask a question about this. So I'm acknowledging that. If you want to weigh in on this, you can. But you, I don't believe, have read the story, so
no,
I don't want to hit you with an unfair question.
I have not read the story, so I certainly cannot speak to what Representative Holly Grange's report said. But I will say this, that in a lot of these things, you know, it really falls to the person that's filing the reports, and that's whether you're filing your economic interest statement or whether you're filing your income taxes. You know, one answer would be, you know, we need more and more policemen to oversee this. Another way is to increase the penalties for people when they don't do things correctly and really put that onus on the individual, that personal responsibility to pull that back. So that would really be my only comment on this. So, you know, I'm not sure that we need more people to be policemen. I think we need more people filling out their forms correctly. And also, you know, part of this could be that in the instructions to do this, whether it's for a candidate or whether it's serving on a state board or state agency or whether it's, you know, filling out your income taxes, that there are some clear instructions of how to do it so that people understand how to do it. I think most people do that in an honest way. But things always fall through the cracks.
You think most people fill out their taxes honestly?
I think with the penalties that are in place when you don't, I think most people at least try to. And a lot of people pay a lot of tax attorneys a lot of money to get that done straight.
I think bottom line, it wouldn't hurt to have 25 employees checking these things instead of 8 or whatever it is in the State Ethics Commission, checking to make sure that these are filed properly. This is important public business. It's an important concept that our public officials properly and accurately disclose what their economic interest is, so the public can know if they have a conflict of interest when they're voting on something. And that's an increasing problem in our especially when you've got a part-time legislature in which the members of the legislature have their fingers, many of them, in all kinds of businesses. So, you know, I agree with Becky. Maybe stronger penalties would be good too. But the bottom line is this is kind of boilerplate basic democracy stuff, and it's disturbing that someone who's running for governor would have years.
There have been questions about some of Roy Cooper's disclosures on his reports as well. So, you know, to me, it comes down to personal responsibility. And if you want to be a public servant or you want to serve on a state agency board, then you ought to assume the responsibility. And part of that is disclosure and transparency and these things that are required.
And for balance, if I remember, it's been 8 years now, but there were questions about then candidate Pat McCrory's disclosures as well, if he was properly disclosing everything from his 29 years with Duke Energy.
There's no doubt that it's a very complicated area, and all of these politicians could invest a little more energy in getting it right. It would be to the public's interest.
Rob Schofield directs NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy the holiday weekend, gang.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
As you're aware, Pod drops twice a week. Friday Conversations with Becky and Rob can be found wherever you do on-demand listening. You can also hear a portion of our conversations on the radio, 4:50 Friday afternoons on All Things Considered on WUNC. Earlier in the week, you get those long-form deep dive convos. The next one you'll hear is a chat with WBTV's Nick Ochsner. Taped it earlier this week. We had, I thought, a really good conversation, working on editing that down, and you'll hear most of our chatter come Tuesday of next week. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff, reminding you to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks for listening. Enjoy that holiday weekend.